It's the Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. 3 years after the American Civil Liberties Union of Pennsylvania filed a class action lawsuit, the ACLU and the city of Pittsburgh have reached an agreement on what are being called cutting-edge improvements to police hiring methods, including strengthening minority hiring procedures. The settlement agreement stems from a federal class action lawsuit filed by the ACLU in August of 2012 on behalf of minority applicants who scored high in Pittsburgh police testing but were passed over for job offers. But how will it improve minority hiring and eliminate discriminatory practices? I'm joined now by Ellen Doyle, one of the attorneys representing the plaintiffs in the case. Ellen Doyle, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. It's great to be here.
If you have a comment or a question for our guest, you can weigh in at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. How was this case settled, Ellen? You had a very contentious situation here, and it didn't look like there was an easy solution. I'm guessing some of it had to do with when Mayor Peduto took office at the beginning of last year, 2014. I'm guessing that sort of greased the skids toward an agreement.
Well, that helped. I mean, we actually started negotiations in 2013. And at that time, the city and we agreed. We went to a mediation session with a mediator. The city agreed, and we agreed, to go try something fairly different, which was we jointly hired an expert in the field. And that expert was someone named Dr. Lietta Hugh. She's an industrial psychologist out of Minnesota. She has a great deal of experience working in how to improve selection procedures, and particularly in how to work out selection procedures for police departments and law enforcement. We jointly retained her. She came in. She spent a number of days here. She got volumes of materials about how police selection occurred. She talked to many players, both inside and outside of the police, community members, the command staff, various people that both we, our plaintiffs, and other people in the community and in the professional world in Pittsburgh, and came up with a set of recommendations for how to improve the police selection process and what some of the problems were. At that point, though it was going to still be a long process to determine what we were going to do, whether any money would be paid, which we were quite insisting upon that there
You're
should
talking
be
about a settlement in which the city would agree to pay reparations to the eligible African-American police applicants?
Yes.
And in that settlement, as long as you brought that up, the city agreed to pay nearly $1 million, the exact figure, $985,000 total to eligible African-American police applicants who were not issued job offers from 2008 to 2014. How was that figure arrived at?
Well, that's a fairly complicated question, but part of it was looking at the number of slots that African Americans should have received, what we thought were the slots they should have received if the hiring had been fair and non-discriminatory, and then negotiating, because your first number is not your last number, negotiating to a number that we thought was appropriate in the circumstances, and then coming up with a formula, which we're still working on and tweaking, coming up with a formula for distribution of those monies.
Going back to Liette Hugh, you mentioned who she was, what she did, her role in helping to broker this agreement, and she's a police hiring expert and industrial psychologist. And I understand she's going to continue to have a role. What will she do?
Yes, the city has had an outside consultant involved in certain aspects of its police selection for a long time, a group called E.B. Jacobs. We, as part of the settlement, Dr. Hugh, who was the jointly retained expert and gave us the initial thoughts about how to improve hiring, she will continue in the selection process and to make sure, one, that the recommendations that she made are transformed into reality and adopted by the city, and also to look at the whole process. There were some aspects of the process that Dr. Hugh did not look at before, and to be there to so at least from our point of view, there is someone who is more independent than the consultants who had been consulting for the city for a long time.
And so it comes down to now this idea of, you know, what is the ideal, but at the same time, how it will be achieved in this agreement. By the way, the city denies the lawsuit's allegations of discriminatory hiring practices. Explain this. If the city's not willing to acknowledge that, is that an impediment to getting to where you want to be with minority hiring?
It is very common to settle, or in the settlement, for the defendant to deny liability. There was a judge in the Southern District of New York who took on an SEC settlement where the SEC did not require a finding of liability by a large bank that had been sued.
I'm guessing this is something involving the Securities and Exchange Commission during the
financial crisis.
Stock market crisis.
Right.
Yeah.
And,
they had nothing to do with it. I mean, a lot of people would debate that, but I can see where if you can legally negotiate that into the settlement, why not?
So it was sort of controversial, but the courts have not required settlements to have these agreements that you're liable. They can have other consequences in a settlement. And so most defendants won't do it, and it's very common to settle without them. In fact, I'd say it's very unusual to get an agreement that somebody was liable in a settlement.
Okay, so the city's saying that they deny the lawsuit's allegations of discriminatory hiring practices, but they are acknowledging to one extent that there is a problem that must be addressed. So it comes back to then those questions, those key questions, of how will this settlement improve minority hiring? How will it eliminate discriminatory practices?
All right. I don't know whether it will eliminate discriminatory practices because our hope is to improve and reduce any discrimination. Eliminating is hard because of the number of ways in which the testing could have adverse impact on minorities. How it will do that by addressing almost every phase of hiring. Police hiring is actually quite a complicated process. There's a written exam, there are oral boards, there's a fitness exam, there's a psych exam, I think there are 12 steps, there's a polygraph, there's a background examination. So we have been looking at really every aspect of that process to see how it can be improved to have less of a discriminatory impact on African Americans, and to look also around the country and see, is anybody doing this better? And if so, how are they doing it? Surprisingly, some of the testing has not really been tested in what I would call a true scientific way, where you look 20 years later, who were the good police and how did they rank on a written test? There hasn't been that type of testing. And some of this, you know, one of the problems with the Pittsburgh police hiring was that there were rankings based on the joint scores on your written or oral test. So the rankings could very much affect African Americans ranked. But there's no indication that those two scores exactly mean you're going to be a good police officer. And so a 30-point difference might mean the difference between getting hired. But it wouldn't mean there's no validity between saying this one's going to be a great officer and this one's going to be not a great officer. So part of what we were trying to do is do less screening out of candidates and more screening in of people who have the characteristics that we want in a good police force: integrity, professionalism. But one of the other things that is very important in police forces, as we've seen around the country, is an orientation towards service and service to your community, the ability to deal with communities who are different, and in Pittsburgh we see it, different neighborhoods are quite different. We want people who can deal with those issues in the community and be out there and be service-oriented. And we were not necessarily looking for that. We weren't screening in or trying to find people with those characteristics.
We're talking with Ellen Doyle. She's one of the attorneys representing the plaintiffs in the class action lawsuit brought by the ACLU of Pennsylvania against the city of Pittsburgh in August of 2012. There has been a settlement agreement. It was announced last week between the city and the ACLU. So now we are looking at not only what's in the settlement, but what will be included in terms of improving minority hiring and dealing with discriminatory practices. And Ellen Doyle, one of the things that caught our eye in the statement issued by the city of Pittsburgh was that there would be cutting-edge improvements to police hiring methods. Now, maybe perhaps what you've just outlined is part of that, but you know, cutting-edge, it's an intriguing phrase. And so what about this agreement makes it cutting-edge?
Well, I think that the change from screening out to screening in is something that is quite different than the way most police departments across the country have been screening out people. You know, oh, you have a marijuana offense, you're out, even though it was 10 years ago when you were 15 years old. Hmm. And those types of screen outs have a particular impact on African Americans because they have more, there is more likelihood that they may have been had interactions with police forces. There are more police in their neighborhoods. There are more African Americans. The ACLU did a study in Pennsylvania that came out in June of 2013 that showed 5.2 times the likelihood for African Americans versus whites to be arrested for marijuana possession.
So it's like this catch 22 where you're more likely to have had some sort of negative interaction with the police, and years later you're an adult, you may be a completely different person in many ways, as most of us are by the time we age, or as we age, and so you decide, I'd like to serve the community, I'd like to be on the police force, and oh well, you've got this mark on your record, and so you're out, as you say. So the idea of making it more inclusive is part of it. It sounds like it's a bigger change than we might readily understand at first.
Yes, I think we have not been screening in, and we also are trying to deal with putting some time limits. Having a marijuana, you know, if you look at my age, if I had a offense, it would be a long time ago if I had a youthful indiscretion defense. But for younger, a lot of the candidates for police officers are younger. Can we have some rules that say if it happened when you were 15 and you're now 25, that's a remote in time occurrence? And we might not have that for a very serious crime, but certainly for marijuana possession or the types of or a driving infraction that get allowing people to have had some problems in their record, but that doesn't mean that they can't be a police officer. I think that makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense in terms of what we know about the development of the brain, which is you don't get your full upper frontal cortex until age 25. So
they certainly say that they say that about teenage boys in particular.
Yes, and of course another issue which was not part of our lawsuit is increasing the hiring of women at the police force, which I think they will also be looking into. But we have a lot of males applying for police officer jobs.
And when you look at the statistics, currently the police bureau in Pittsburgh is 85% white, 13% African-American. Are there target numbers for improving these statistics? Are there built-in stipulations for incremental progress in this area? If what you're looking to do is to diversify the police force, what will determine that progress is being made and over what period of time?
Sure. Well, the first thing you need to know about those statistics is that includes a lot of African Americans who were hired when the city of Pittsburgh was under a federal court order to diversify, under which they had to hire an African-American and a female out of every four hires. So that helped us become one of the most diversified police forces in the country. Since the federal court vacated that order, and it, certainly in the years preceding the filing of this lawsuit, we were hiring 4% African-Americans at the city, even though we have a population of 26% African-American.
Well, so, even if it's 13, that represents half of the population of African-Americans in Pittsburgh. So then is the target to get those numbers more in line, more representative of what the population breakdown is?
Yes, certainly. In fact, the city was reporting for a number of years that they were disproportionately white in terms of the population in the city. We also, but the difference between the what happened with the prior federal lawsuit and what happened now is that the Supreme Court has seriously reduced the use of any race-conscious remedy, so that this settlement does not have the type of, you know, you have to hire one African-American out of every little group of hires. We do not have those kinds of quotas in this hiring. But we are trying to change the processes so African-Americans can be not selected out on the basis of minor infractions. And we also, when we looked through the files, we saw, we were told our clients weren't hired because, you know, one had a minor had some traffic violations. Another one had...
Traffic violations?
Yes, moving violations.
Wow.
Another one had marijuana use, although it was in junior high. But when we looked at the files, white people with those same types of offenses, you know, they had been hired.
And that would be overtly discriminatory.
Right. When you got into the background files, we felt that there was much more indication that, or that blacks were scrutinized more. Their resumes and backgrounds were given a much harder time than the whites, so that there was disparate treatment.
So how do you monitor that then? If I mean, this is clearly cherry picking off of somebody's resume and record, you know, that you're letting it go for a white person, but not for an African-American person. So how do you enforce that? Will somebody go back and look at that and say, hey, you hired a white officer who had a series of moving violations. Here is a similarly qualified African-American candidate who has that same thing on his record, and yet you didn't hire. What will someone then go in and do? Question that? You know, will there be a rule in place? How will that work?
Well, there will be a couple of things that you can do. One is decide what's important and what's not. If you have a summary that just lists the – if you decide some things aren't important, if a 10-year-old marijuana possession isn't important, don't put it into the materials that that people are reviewing.
So if you eliminate it from the materials, then you don't have – that's one less thing that someone can – that can perhaps lead someone who is doing the hiring to take the same information and look at it differently.
Yes, that's one
possibility. Or to lead to an improper interpretation.
Right. So that would be the one thing, and we're talking about.
So just take it all out of there.
Right. Another possibility is to have more the personal statement. Tell me what's good about you as a candidate. But there's a surprisingly small amount of that in the process at the moment. Well, wouldn't you like to hear that someone, maybe they came in up and they had a lot of trouble when they were a teenager and they had a lot of family problems, but they're resilient. They've gotten past that. You're going to give that person some points for that, but the process wasn't really giving an adequate way for people to tell the story of their life and why they would be a good community-oriented police officer. And we want to do some of that so that the screen out process wasn't getting enough of the full story. You could get, and I don't want to denigrate anybody who's currently on the police force, but you might be hiring somebody that's really a blank slate. They just didn't get in trouble. They didn't have interactions with the police, but you don't know that much about them. So I think we think that this is a very much better way to do this. And we're also trying to get more training for everybody going through the who are the selectors to teach them about what we know a lot about is implicit bias. And I think David Harris knows something. You may be talking to him about
that
later.
He's coming right up, yes.
But implicit bias is as that which is not conscious. You know, it's not saying African Americans are worse, but all these studies show that that when African Americans are reviewed, their work is criticized more. People have they have all these, you know, things that are more sort of automatic. It's why African Americans might be more likely to be shot, just because people attribute 5 extra years to some kid. So a kid who's 13, if you're a white officer, you often think that kid is 18. That's implicit bias. You would know a kid 13 is going to act goofy and silly if it's a white kid. But if it's an African-American kid and you're saying, oh, that looks like an 18-year-old, you think you expect something different. And it seems more dangerous when the kid gets all flustered. They did a study last year of sending out a memo inside of law firms. And the study showed that a memo that was identified as from an African-American associate rather than from a Caucasian associate was panned. It was criticized more. They found more problems with the memo and all of this. This is lawyers in top law firms were just looking for more errors if race was identified. So those are the types of problems that you have to get through and figure out what you're going to do about in screening it. It's not completely easy to do it, but it is the problem. And it's the one that was trying to be solved by a very cooperative process in the new hiring process.
We're coming almost to time for the segment, but do you want to take one phone call from Paul in Oakmont, who's been listening and has come up with a question?
Sure.
All right, Paul, you're on with Ellen Doyle, one of the attorneys representing the plaintiffs in the ACLU of Pennsylvania class action lawsuit against the city of Pittsburgh over police hiring practices. Go ahead, Paul.
Thank you. You know, there's a lot of discussion about the hiring process, but who within the city has been charged with making the decision to forego one candidate who has in favor of another when they both have similar youthful indiscretions?
It's a good question, Paul. So are we talking about a single individual, Ellen, perhaps a panel of people hiring personnel? How does it work?
You know, Paul, part of the problem is that this is such a, you know, a 12-step process. The people were getting thrown out at different things. And the background investigation, for example, the people who go out and try to do a background investigation, if you come to my building, I live in a building where I, at age 65, am one of the youngest people in the building. My building, if you came in, everybody will know each other. But if you go into a neighborhood, such as an African-American neighborhood, people might not open their door to you if you say, I'm from the city's Office of Municipal Investigations. So you might have a harder time having your neighbors say, oh, this is a great person. At every step of the way, there are problems. It was not one person. There was a process. There were background investigations conducted by different investigators. They have a boss. There is a civil service, there's a head of personnel. That person has multiple people. If you got past all of these different stages, you got to the chief's round table, and that was a group of the command staff of the police. It's hard to put the finger on one person, but that's where all of the things that led up to that caused the fact was only 4% of the police officers being hired were African American.
Ellen Doyle is one of the attorneys who represented the plaintiffs in the ACLU of Pennsylvania class action lawsuit against the city of Pittsburgh over police hiring practices. Ellen Doyle, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for sharing so much information with us.
Thank you. It's been great to be here.
Coming up in a recent op-ed piece for the Post-Gazette, Pitt Law Professor David Harris outlined ways police departments should adapt. He joins us along with Nation Swell writer Christopher Peake, who looks at what might encourage minorities to join law enforcement. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. From Ferguson, Missouri to Baltimore, the tense nature of police-community relations has been garnering national headlines. In a recent op-ed for the Post-Gazette, Pitt Law professor David Harris outlined ways policies and police departments should adapt. He joins us now in Studio A. David Harris, welcome back to the program. Good to have you.
Good to be with you again, Paul.
Also, how do you recruit minorities who mistrust the police to join law enforcement? Joining us to address that and other questions is Christopher Peek, staff writer for Nation Swell, who looked into the issue. He joins us by phone. Christopher Peek, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me.
And you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh at wesa.fm. On Twitter at esspgh. David, you say the most fundamental aspect of successful modern policing is cooperation between the police and the communities they serve. Explain how this should work.
Well, Paul, this goes all the way back to the beginning of organized police departments when Sir Robert Peel, who organized the very first police department in London, observed that the people are the police and the police are the people. You have to have a relationship based on trust, a real partnership between police and those they serve. That's the only way that there's real communication and real strong relationships. That is the core of how police know what the community is like, what it's doing, what it needs, and who is up to what. Because we all know police can't be everywhere at once. We all know that it's the people who live and work in a community who know what's happening there, who the right people are who belong there, and who is from the outside, maybe suspicious, whatever. You need to have a strong relationship with the people you serve. Only with that relationship can the police do the thorough job, the complete job that we need, along with the community, of bringing public safety to the highest point. Police can't do it alone. The community can't do it alone. There must be a partnership.
And you also say a police department should resemble the community it serves with regard to race, ethnicity, and gender. How does this help to gain trust and support of the community?
Well, what we know is that if a police department does not look like the community it serves in any of those ways, it tends to erode the trust that is so important to having that good relationship with people. So if a group of people, a racial group, an ethnic group, is not part of the police department, and people don't see people like themselves on the police department, they begin to wonder whether that police department has their interests at heart. Now, even if a police department has the same percentage of race or ethnic group X on its police department as exists in the population, that by itself will not make it a good police department. It needs to resemble the people they serve so that it can have the confidence of people. It needs to be well-trained and well-run in order to be a good police department. So it's a necessary condition. It isn't a sufficient condition to have good policing. But if you don't have it, you will undermine the confidence of the public, and people will wonder, what's with this police department? Why doesn't anybody here look like me?
And when it comes to the stats on diversity in the police force, what are you seeing, Christopher Peek?
Across the nation?
Yes, sir.
Well, what it looks like is currently we don't have police departments that look like our communities. We have ones that are largely much more white than the communities that they're serving. And I think this gets back to exactly what David was saying, is that people can't trust a community, their police officers, if they don't see someone that looks exactly like them. Someone that has shared their same cultural experiences or just the experiences of what it's like to grow up in that city. And if we don't see that just in your police officer walking his beat or driving around, you're not going to be able to approach them if you're in trouble or see them as on your side if you have an encounter with them.
David, is this what we have in Pittsburgh right now?
In Pittsburgh right now, we have a police department that's approximately 15-16% African-American, as your last guest, Ellen Doyle, said. Now, this is largely because there was a federal court order some decades ago that ordered the hiring of more African-American and female officers.
So it could actually be even less.
Well, at this point, what we're seeing is an erosion of those officers who were hired in that cohort as those people hired a couple of decades ago and more retire. And they are not being replaced at nearly the same rate within the police department as they were in the past. Now, I know the Pittsburgh Police Department wants to hire a more diverse force. That has been one of their goals for a long time under Chief Harper, under Chief McClay. They've wanted to do that, but Pittsburgh is in a similar situation to police departments all over the country. And I'm sure Chris knows this. It's been really tough to recruit people from ethnic and racial minority groups.
Chris, you quoted a former prosecutor named Dolores Jones Brown as saying that racial minorities often don't sign up as recruits because they don't want to become part of what's seen as the problem. How much does this account for the low numbers?
Sure. So this stigma that people have, this perception of the police department as being an enemy, starts early and just grows worse over time with each negative interaction that a person would have with the police department. If you grew up in a community like Baltimore, where one in five men are in jail, you associate the police as the person who locked up your dad, your brother, your friends. If you grew up in the Bronx or in Harlem, where until recently stop and frisk was the declared policy of the New York Police Department, you become an outsider in your own community. Each time the police stop you and start to search you, you begin to think of yourself as being a thug, and it's police that make you feel that way. So what Dolores Jones Brown told me is that the only way that we're going to change the perception of police departments is once we stop the surveillance and targeting of young men and women of color. That's essential, and that's a policy action, but those types of policies are going to emerge once police departments have voices within them that say that these policies can change. And I think that's something that David mentioned earlier. Diversity is necessary, but it's not sufficient. When we talk about recruiting minority police officers, that's just one side of the coin. The other one is retaining the police officers. And that sounds like a problem currently in Pittsburgh. The culture within the police department is hugely important, and that's something that needs to change in order to keep these young minority officers that you're recruiting and make them feel as if they're a part of the institution so that they can actually go out and create that change themselves.
How do you change perceptions? I mean, how do you – what you've just articulated one potential solution or perhaps a key element of the solution, but then how do you do that? How do you gain – the trust of people who have distrusted you for so long?
Sure. So this is the tough question. There's not a very easy answer, but I think there's two parts of it. One is that the what seems to be in vogue these days is this idea of community policing, of having your officers out on the streets, people that are just there that you can talk to, that are walking up to homes and talking with neighbors, rather than police that are driving around in their patrol cars and just trying to put out small fires and respond to crimes just based on what's happening on their 911 calls. So seeing an officer who's out there on the beat, the same beat all the time, so that you know his name, you can approach him when you have an issue or just chat with him on the street, seems to be essential. And I sort of talked about this in the article, that as long as people start hearing the names of Freddie Gray or Michael Brown, those names are going to be much more associated with the police department unless they start to begin to know the name of their own officer who's standing on the corner. So I think that's one, is to just have a very personal interaction and know who's in your police department. The second one is that, and it's sort of an admission that older generations might be kind of lost in terms of changing perceptions. They might be calcified in their opinions, but you need to really start young before people begin to associate police as being either an ally or an enemy, to reach them in schools, to have summer police academies, to do recruiting as some departments are doing as early as high school, and catch kids before they've had a negative interaction with the police and begin to associate them as being the enemy.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we need to take one more break, and we'll continue this discussion with David Harris, Pitt Law Professor, and Christopher Peek, staff writer for Nation Swell, looking into the issue of police-community relations. How can they be improved? It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking about the nature of police-community relations, which have been tense in the wake of recent events. How can they be improved? And with us is a frequent guest, a very insightful man when it comes to law enforcement, Pitt Law Professor David Harris, who recently outlined ways police departments should adapt in 2015. And also with us is Christopher Peake, staff writer for Nation Swell, who looked into this issue. He's with us by phone. You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM, on Twitter at ESSPGH. Chris Peake, you looked into, did some research into how many police departments around the country have undertaken efforts to recruit minority officers, and from what I saw in your piece, it's surprisingly low. There's not much of an effort, as you might think, that's been undertaken there.
Very low. So there's about 12,500 police departments across the country, and only one in five have undertaken any recruitment efforts specifically for minority officers. To some extent, that's those 12,000 police departments are small, they're rural, they say they don't have a budget to do so. So that partially explains why, but for the most part, a lot of the experts that I talked to said you can't justify not having these recruitment efforts just simply based on lack of funds. It really comes down to a lack of initiative. And these police chiefs or higher-ups within the department need to be the ones that are going out in their community and actually doing that recruiting.
David, is diversity, though, the panacea? Does diversity by itself produce a well-functioning department?
No, not necessarily, Paul. I think that it's a necessary condition for it, but it isn't enough by itself. And if you want to have a good department, you have to look at some of the other ways in which police departments need to function in the 21st century. You need that commitment to partnership. You need to use a focused deterrence strategy in order to make sure that your efforts are targeted at the right people instead of on everybody in the community. You need a modern use of force policy. You need to deal with bias, unconscious bias, as your last guest was talking about so well. You need to talk about having an early intervention system. All of these things together make the whole picture. Diversity alone is important, but it isn't enough to have a good police department.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation with Pitt Law Professor David Harris and Christopher Peake, staff writer for Nation Swell. 412-246-2002 if you have a comment or a question. Also, email ESSPGH at WESA.FM, on Twitter at ESSPGH. David, you say police departments should embrace complaints from the community, which they are sometimes reluctant to do. Why is that?
Well, nobody likes to hear complaints about how they do their job, let's face it. But as we've seen over and over now in the modern retail industry, companies know that complaints are nothing more than a source of data. This is how they learn about themselves, how they figure out what their customers want and what they don't want. Now, the police department is not a business. I'm not saying that. And citizens are not customers. But what I am saying is that if you want to know how well your department is functioning in its interactions with police, if you want to know if you have a general systemic problem, if you want to know if you have problems with particular officers, you must be open to complaints. So you have to have a complaint process that allows citizens, even encourages them to come forward, give you their complaints, and you have to have a complaint system, frankly, that will follow through and give citizens the idea that their complaint matters and that you've heard them and that you're taking action. If you don't do those things, citizens will not bother. They will know that it's for nothing. But if you do those, it is a chance to improve. And any organization, be it a business, an organization like a police department, a university, should always want to be continuously improving. That's why it's important to be open to complaints.
And another question we'd like to put out to our listeners is, what do you think should be done to improve minority hiring among police officers, among police forces? How do you recruit more minority officers? What are the practices and policies that can be improved in that regard? And, of course, there are the trust issues. How can that be improved between the police and the community? Christopher Peek, you interviewed the National Association of Black Police Officers. Do they have any initiatives to attract minorities to careers as police officers?
Yeah, so their main initiative is starting young, as I said earlier. They're really targeting historically black colleges and universities and making sure that there's career fairs there where law enforcement is represented. You need to start young, and police work is actually very reliable, and it's a position that you can do well in and make a career out of. But because there is this negative stigma, that hasn't been something that's been available to a large percentage of the black community. They just don't feel that they'll be welcome there, even though it is a very decent job to have. So recruiting at historically black colleges is one of their efforts. And then they're just going out to different police chiefs and saying, you need to also be doing this recruiting, whether it's at your churches, your cultural festivals, your NAACP meetings, or other places in the community. They're really pushing the leadership at different departments to make sure that they're doing their own recruiting as well.
Let's go to the phones at 412-246-2002. We have Steve in Pittsburgh with a question. Steve, welcome. You're on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. In the past few months, maybe years, the focus, focal point in the media has been the events where police officers are shot and killed suspects. What is the policy, maybe nationally as well as locally, as far as shooting to maim? Like aiming a little lower?
This is a good question, and I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about this, Steve. Police departments train their officers to use force along a continuum. You may use force as a police officer to carry out your job, whether it's to effectuate an arrest or to bring down a dangerous suspect or whatever it happens to be. You may not use more force than is necessary to do that, and police departments all should, and most do, in fact, have policies that limit the use of force to only the amount reasonably necessary to overcome resistance and achieve the goal that they have under the law. They have generally no policy for shooting to maim. If you are going to use a firearm on a suspect, on a person who you're in a confrontation with, the police training for a generation at least has been, if you're going to use the firearm, you shoot for center mass. You shoot only to kill. Now, that doesn't mean that you want the suspect to die. It doesn't mean that you, in every instance, that you want to kill the person. It simply means if you're going to be that serious, you got to go all the way. It's got to be completely the right thing to do. If you shoot to maim, you will not stop the life-threatening actions of the suspect. The only time you could use a firearm is if the suspect is threatening deadly force to the officer or to another person. So there's no reason that a police officer should draw a weapon and shoot only to maim. That won't stop the problem.
And if someone is trying to get away from you, that is not just cause for an officer to fire?
Correct. You have to be a little more specific. A person running away could, in some instances, still pose a deadly danger. Imagine a person running away with a firearm in hand who still poses a threat. That might be an occasion where you might still use deadly force. But generally speaking, a fleeing suspect, certainly an unarmed fleeing suspect, no. Deadly force is not available to the officer.
Let's go to Jim in Squirrel Hill. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Okay, hi. My question goes to an earlier point. I've taught criminal justice for some 40 years at a local college, and I think that in order to get the police that we want, minorities and others, we have to start addressing where the students are coming in who expect ultimately to go into police work. When the students come into my classes, often they, even at that point, present attitudes that are very not conducive to what I would like to see them having going into police work. I think we need to have people in there from police departments saying, these are the legitimate expectations, these are the kinds of people we're looking for. I don't know. I'd like to get people's reactions to that. We should be starting, well, not starting at that point, but certainly working at that level, because I know they bring attitudes into my classes. I'm black, okay, and I know that some of my students come into my classes with very negative attitudes, seeing my presence there in front of them. It's interesting. I don't know what the thought would be about having more done prior to the police academy. I mean, these are people who are going in to go into the police academy ultimately, but they're in my classes and other classes around Pittsburgh and the other colleges and what have you before they go to the police academy.
So, Jim, are you suggesting perhaps that what we need are some sensitivity training or things that root out implicit bias?
Yes, and we need people from the police departments with the right attitudes coming in, talking to my students. We need Professor Harris talk. I've had him come in to talk to a group of my students once a while ago. I don't know that he would remember. But, we need sensitivity training. We need that stuff not when they get to the police. A police academy would be good. That's great. I'm not knocking that. But they have these attitudes before they get there, because they have generated them, they've built them up, and they're ready to go already.
It's a great point, Jim. Christopher Peek, what about that? Are you hearing that? I'm sorry, go ahead.
There is this question of implicit bias that needs to be dealt with, and a large part of that depends on how you change the department culture. There's two interesting studies that came out, one in Florida, another one in Cincinnati, that actually said that black officers were more likely than whites to use coercive force against a black suspect or a minority suspect. And a lot of the experts speculate that the reason for that is because they either feel pressure to show their colleagues that, hey, I can do this too, I'm just like you, I'm no different, actually feel more pressure to perform, or that they are just adopting these biases. So I think that's... just to go to this point, that this isn't going to be a very easy change. It's not just simply a matter of, can we hire this certain quota, reach a percentage where our police department looks like our community. But it's true, you do need to change these internal perceptions and the implicit biases that people have. And there's a couple ways you can do that. One is by making sure that you have minorities at all levels of the police department rather than just in your police academy or your cadet classes. And making sure that they feel welcome there.
Does it make a difference, Chris? Does it make a difference if officers live in a community?
The research is a little bit complicated on that, and it seems as if the answer is no. Pittsburgh, for example, has had residency requirements since 1902, and they're about average in terms of police departments across the country for the large cities. But when you map out all the different rankings, the ones that have residency requirements actually seem to not perform so well in terms of having diversity. That seems to be because they're limiting the pools from which they can draw from. You might be able to give points on the police academy exam for living within a community, but having a residency requirement does not seem to be productive because it really just limits the pool to the people that live within city limits.
David, we've got about 20 seconds. I wanted to let you make a final point.
Well, I recognize Jim's voice, and I remember his class well. I would just say that it depends on how we select our candidates. In the past, it was all about military or law enforcement experience. Select people based on the attitudes you want to see and the experiences they've had in life.
It's been an interesting conversation. Thank you for taking part in it, gentlemen. Pitt Law Professor David Harris and Christopher Peek, staff writer for Nation Swell. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Nice to be with you, Paul.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.